Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm not too bad. Not too bad at all.
Marvelous. Marvelous. Good to hear. We spoke earlier on and you told me about a tree.
Yeah. I'm gutted, man. So we're talking on the day that Dumbledore's died. I know
Yep, that
this
means
is
a lot
like,
more for you than it does for me because I've never
it
watched
does.
any of those
But
because I was an adult when they came out, but yep.
for our lovely listeners, today is the day that on recording that Michael Gambon passed away, sadly. I thought that was bad news enough. However, I then found out that the Sycamore Gap tree, or also known as the Robin Hood tree, got chopped down last night by, it appears to be, a 16-year-old now. 16-year-old has been arrested. That's the latest news. I just heard it on Six Music that this guy is helping with inquiries.
Yeah, that old classic.
But it's one of probably the most iconic trees in the country. And I love it. I think it's awesome. Now we're talking past tense. I'm quite chuffed that I did get to see it a couple of times. I didn't manage to get up to it close, but I did see it from the main road, and it's just sad. It's just really sad.
And completely unnecessary because all that happened was it was chopped down and then left. So
Yeah.
no one's made any gain out of it. It's not
No.
been chopped down to, I don't know, to sell the wood or anything like that. It's just like it seems like an act of vandalism, and that's it.
Yeah, just some kid having a laugh, and I'd chop his hands off. Going
It's
on, going on,
absolutely
going on the
bizarre.
Robin Hood Prince of Thieves classic. I think the punishment back then would have been chop his hands off.
Oh, okay. All right. I
Kevin
think we've moved
Costner,
a bit past that, but
Kevin Costner was about to get his hand chopped off for stealing bread. So I say
was
Kevin Costner, Robin Hood was about to get his
it?
hand off for stealing bread, or his mate was. So yeah, I think get this lad's hands chopped off. That'll learn him.
He won't do it again. Right. Not sure I agree with that, but it's very annoying that someone would
I don't really mean it. I'm just saying it for
it
comedy effects, violent
It's
comedy effects.
very annoying that someone would do that for no apparent reason. Just seems
Yeah.
completely bizarre. Completely bizarre.
Just
Anyway,
madness.
shall I tell you about today's guest?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Go for it.
Today's guest is our first from Africa,
Wow.
and he is a former farmer, which is not easy for me to say, from
Wow,
South
okay.
Africa, who, basically came to veganism through what seems like a fairly, so far for us anyway, unique experience of having been a farmer and realized what was going on. What was being done to animals, and then came to veganism that way. So he's written a book about his vegan journey as well, which
Right.
is available on his website, which we'll link to in the
Cool.
show notes. And his name is J.H. Burnett, and we'll be speaking to him very shortly, which
Yeah.
is very exciting. Some of the content of our chat with J.H. is going to be could be triggering for some people. And I put a trigger warning on the show notes and on our social media posts. But there's going to be a lot of talk about animal abuse and suicide. So just be aware if that you think that might affect you, then perhaps this isn't the episode for you. Or if it does affect you, what do they need to do is?
Just take care of yourself. If you need to talk to somebody, go talk to them. Talk to your friends, talk to your family, talk to anyone that can help. But please, please, please take care of yourself. A bit of it bothered me a little bit. So if it bothered me enough, then it's going to bother other people that are listening. So please take care of yourself. Thank you.
There's professional help out there. You can reach out to us, but we're not, well, Wes is a professional, but in a urgent situation, Probably
I'm
best
not,
not to send us a message
yeah,
on Instagram.
I'm not a crisis line.
No. But if you need support, then there's plenty of places that you can find it. Your local NHS website will be able to help with that.
Yeah.
It's good to see you guys. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
And you, man.
Three men with beards. That's the kind of setup that we like. So
crazy stuff. I still have a long way to go. I see.
Yeah.
But you guys are looking good. Love the beards. Yeah.
Hey, this has taken a good 8 years. It doesn't grow as fast as you think.
Is it? Jeez, man, I don't have the patience. I tend to neglect mine. I've had a longer one at times, but then I always find myself in a position where, you know, it gets sort of tangled, and then my wife would just say, just give it up, man. If you ain't going to take good care of it, just cut it off. So that's why I have a nice short one, yeah.
Yeah, easier to maintain.
Yeah, there's a long regime with this after the shower. I'm not going into that. We'll perhaps do a full episode on it later on another time.
Yeah, Wes's beard care. Thank you so much for joining us. What's the time difference between South Africa and the UK? Because I always sort of picture it as being straight down from where we are to where you are, but that's not quite correct, is it?
So is it 7:30 where you're at, right?
Yes. Yes.
So it's 8:30 where I'm at. So 1 hour before you guys. Yeah. I actually thought it was two, but it's only one.
Awesome. Okie dokie. And which bit of South Africa are you in? Whereabouts?
So I'm
it,
in a,
as if I know
in
South
a
Africa.
Small, yeah, you see. Yeah. It's anyway, it's down in the Western Cape. It's a small little remote town right by the ocean called Wilderness. And it's actually quite beautiful. Yeah, it's very forestry, and obviously you've got the long white beaches, but it's in the Western Cape, about 6 hours drive from Cape Town, which is the biggest city.
6 hours. Okay.
It's a big place, man. South Africa is quite big. And okay. Whereabouts are you guys?
Where's you go first?
So I'm just north of Manchester, up in the north of England.
I'm in Northamptonshire in the Midlands, which is the sort of the bit that people drive through on their way to somewhere else.
Of course. I've only been once to the UK, and I wanted to. We were driving from Scotland down to London, or down to Wales actually, and then I wanted to drive into Manchester to go have a look at the Etihad Stadium, where City plays. And my wife just wanted, you know, it just, she checked the traffic and she said, there is no way we're going to go. Anyway, so I never saw any of it. I saw like the outskirts. That was it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite difficult to get. And it's not difficult to get to. It's just if you're diverting off the motorway, it's a bit of a fair way.
Okay, yeah. If you've got a long trip already, then it's probably not worth a diversion, is it? Yeah.
I see. That's good.
Okay. So are you a Man City fan then, or is that just because it was
no,
on the route?
I am very much a City fan. I got lucky in the late 2000s. I have no idea. I didn't grow up watching football, but then friends introduced me at college, and then I was looking for a team, and then I thought that who better to support than Manchester United's biggest rival in my mind, not knowing that City wasn't the biggest rival. But anyway, I got lucky because a year later they were bought, and then they became this massive, you know, anyway. But what do I know, man? But it's been good. It's been good.
Perfect.
Do you guys follow football?
I do. I was hoping you might be an Everton fan like me because of Steven Pienaar. But sadly
of
not.
No, sadly not. No. Yeah.
Never mind. I don't mind. I don't mind Man City. They're not Man United or those who shall not be named. Yeah. All right. Wes is not a football man.
No, I don't mind watching it. I'll watch a game and enjoy it for what it is. I'm more into me American sports, really. But even then, it's just because I enjoy watching it. I'm not
sure.
I've got I support about six American football teams just because I like the colours.
Yeah, he likes American football, baseball, ice hockey, and shootings and sports.
I've never met someone who was interested in that. It's pretty cool. Yeah, I love it.
I mean, there's some football fans that know the ins and outs of every game for the last 50 years. I don't care. I just watch it and just enjoy it. The quarterback throws the ball, someone catches it, it looks cool, happy days.
And there's a big pile of bodies in the middle.
Yeah. Good stuff, good stuff.
Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about.
Obviously, the story is a bit of a downer, so I don't want to, I mean, want to go into the sort of details that, you know, you're not interested in. So sort of just leave the, I'm open for anything, so that's fine.
Well, I listened a couple of days ago to your interview with No Bullshit Vegan podcast.
Oh, okay.
And
cool.
I didn't find it a downer at all. It's like a redemption tale.
Okay, that's good.
In the intro, I mentioned that you're a former farmer, which is I still find that difficult to say. But you came to veganism through farming. So, and that's a story that we haven't had on our pod before. So, it's we're fascinated by it, really, to be honest with you. So, take us through it. What's your long road to veganism?
Fantastic. Again, thanks for having me, man. I really do appreciate it. In order to sort of understand my journey, you know, I have to take it back to the specific farm that my family owns in South Africa, in almost like the heart of South Africa, in the middle-ish part, which we would call the Great Karoo of South Africa. And what makes this farm quite special, I mean, depending on how you look at it, is that my family has owned it for 253 years. So it's the oldest family-owned farm in all of South Africa, right? At least to our knowledge. So growing up, I didn't grow up there. I grew up on another family farm, but we went there all the time, you know, to go visit the grandparents. And I was sort of brainwashed as a child in believing that this farm, right, this oldest farm, family-owned farm in South Africa, this is like the best farm in all of South Africa, which it really isn't. It's just any other farm. But, you know, at least that was the way that I saw it. And that farming it one day would be like the ultimate honor. But it was never on the card. So I had a dream as a young boy, wanted to farm the farm, and I would have been the ninth generation to do so. But it was never on the cards for me because I was sort of born into the wrong side of the family. So it was never on the cards. But, you know, life has a way of surprising you. So I farmed another family farm. And then in 2018, at the beginning of 2018, that family farm was sold off. And when that happened, I got a phone call asking me, would you be interested, because this very old family farm has various shareholders and their spokesperson. It sounds very formal, but it was quite formal. Phoned me and said, would you be interested in giving up everything and moving out there to the crew to go take over the farm? And of course, my wife and I absolutely leaped at the opportunity, right? I left basically immediately, me and my two bull terriers, the dogs, and my wife stayed behind in our hometown of Worcester because she still had a small business and she needed a couple of months to close that down. And so me and the two dogs left immediately. We were so excited, me and my wife, you know, to be a part of the history of it all, you know. As I said, I was going to be the ninth generation of my family to farm it. And so we're very sentimental, you know, about the whole thing. We obviously, of course, don't come from a vegan background. I went into farming in this case. As I said, I was already a farmer, but I farmed with others before this. So then I went into sheep farming. Of course, I knew I was going to be farming with sheep, but it didn't bother me because I wasn't a vegan at the time. I had no animal liberation background. I'd never spoken to another vegan. Can you imagine this? I was 29 years old at the time, and I'd never even met another vegan in my life up to that point. Mm. So I'd never read a book on animal liberation. I'd never seen a documentary, no, nothing. So went into the farming, not knowing what I was going to get into, very sentimental about the whole thing. And as the story goes, literally from the get-go, from the very first day on the job, it just wasn't a good fit. I started making the one vegan connection after the other. And I refer to them as love connections, where you just, I saw certain things. I challenged the way it was done. I viewed it as immensely cruel. I wasn't happy with the answers that I received. And it sort of started challenging, you know, my wife and I and our morals. And it led us to veganism.
Wow. So you said you didn't have any like connection to animal liberation or veganism or anything like that. Were you even aware that it was a thing? Did you even know that veganism existed or anything? Just never come across, you'd never come across it before.
This is going to sound quite funny, right? I remember this is ridiculous, I know, but I remember telling my wife at one stage, this was my way before we ever moved to the farm, veganism wasn't a thing where I come from, right? Mm-hmm. As I said, I've never met another vegan at that point, but I remember hearing about this vegan movement, people who don't eat animal products. And I remember now, I'm even embarrassed to say this aloud, but I remember asking my wife, why don't these people like animals? In my mind, I couldn't make the connection. It was as if the people who didn't eat animals, what do they have against animals? It was so my perspective was warped. I mean, severely warped, like to the point where I saw veganism as a movement of people who didn't like animals. Can you believe it? Crazy. Yeah.
That's incredible.
I do kind of get it though, in the, yeah, because it's in the sense you've, yeah, it's in, you've kind of got the wrong end of the stick and you've thought, oh, they don't eat animals because they don't like animals or they don't like the taste of animals, rather than
sure,
they're doing it because they like animals.
Yeah, yeah. Even in my mind, it wasn't because they didn't like the taste of animals. It was because they had something against animals. It makes no sense, but as you said, you put it well now, I just got the wrong end of the stick and I ran with it and then I put it out of my mind, right? Yeah.
So one thing that I'm really curious about is someone asked you to come and run a farm. Had you been trained in running a farm or anything? Because I don't feel like it's something that you can just like turn up and do. No, I wouldn't have thought anyway.
No. So at that point, as I said, I was farming, or I had farmed another family farm for several years, and it was an olive farm. So I had work in an agricultural setup. So the trust was there. But then the other thing was, at this new farm, the sheep farm, my grandfather, who was already 80 years old at the time, he was still there living and working on the farm.
Sure.
So the idea was... the idea sold to me was that, JH, move to the farm, go work under your grandfather's leadership for 2 years, learn everything there is to know, then he's going to retire and you're going to take over the farm and lead it into the future. So that was the idea. So I still had his knowledge to fall back on when I moved it. Yes.
Sure. Yeah.
So okay, what happened when you realized that that was... That it wasn't sitting right. What was the next step then after that?
Well, if you don't, maybe I should just share one or two stories, because I said what had happened was on the very first morning when I went there, I remember I was just sort of the silent observer. I didn't go in thinking that I knew nothing, right? So I was there just basically with the mindset, teach me all you have to know, right? So then the guys working on the farm, I went with them on the very first morning on the farm to the pens where they worked with the sheep, right, in inverted commas. And what they were doing on this specific morning, they were docking the sheep, meaning cutting off of the little tiny lamb's tails, right? And I was standing there in the corner shocked by the whole experience, because here were these big guys, you know, grabbing these tiny lambs and cutting off their tails with old, rustic garden scissors of all things. And of course, there was a lot of, you know, screaming, and you know, of the poor lambs, man. If they could talk, you know, they would have wept for their mothers, and would have been like, "What are you doing to us, guys?" It was brutal from my perspective. Blood everywhere. And I asked a couple of questions, and I was sort of put in my place. And the guy said, "No, this is just the way it's always been." But all throughout that day, my heart was troubled by this experience, right? And when the evening came, I drove out to the field where the sheep slept for the night. And I just wanted to go check up on them, right? I just wanted to go make sure that these tiny lambs are okay. And in reaching the flock, there were these two tiny, frail little lambs bleeding profusely from the morning's docking, right? And they were so weak by this point. They were completely covered in blood, their hind sides. And they were so weak, they could no longer walk. And cruel as nature can be, the flock had already given up on them. And they had already sort of began wandering off the night, including their own mother, saying, quite cruel, but you know. As I said, nature can be quite cruel sometimes, but leaving behind these two tiny, bleeding little lambs, and they were calling out to the rest of the flock, and they struggled to walk, and it just completely broke my heart. So I did the only thing that I knew to do, and is I took them home with me, and I took them literally. This is now my first evening on the job, and I took them into our house. Having just moved in, and I took them into our house, and I made them a nice little bed on the kitchen floor, and I, you know, put down some pillows and blankets, and I treated their wounds to the best of my abilities, and I fed them some nice lamb formula milk, and I just sat with them for most of the evening, just loving on them, right? And I just looked into their eyes, and I just made that vegan connection. I could just see the sentience there, and I just knew that these poor little lambs, man, they have the ability to feel love and fear and hope, and they are looking up at me, you know, with these hopeful eyes, almost like, please, Chase, my good man, please save us. And, oh, man, it just broke my heart, man. And I remember sitting there with them, and my two bull terriers were literally in the room next door, separating us with just basically a single door. And I remember sitting there and just thinking to myself, you know, here are these two dogs. And at the time, I felt as if I would be willing to lay my life down for these two dogs. I love them so much, right? And still do. The one, unfortunately, has passed away since then. The other one is still with us today. You know, I love them to bits. I lay my life down for them. But what is the difference between them and these two frail little lambs bleeding on my kitchen floor? What's the difference? How can I love the one and eat the other? It made no sense to me. And so I started asking those questions. And literally the next morning, as life would have it, they had passed away in the evening. And I phoned my wife, and she was crying, and I was crying. And that's how our vegan journey started, you know, on the job, seeing certain things. It didn't make sense. We questioned it. We weren't happy with the answers, and it sort of led us to veganism. If you don't mind, I just want to add, you can imagine that there are countless of these stories, but like a week later, I was sitting early in the morning. I was sitting with my two bull terriers on the back porch, looking, you know, at the sunrise. And one of the guys working on the farm, he walked past my yard. It was, you know, before the day's work was to begin. And the guy passed me, and we greeted one another. And I was sitting there drinking my coffee, and I was watching him from, you know, the corner of my eye. And he went into what we called the sick pen, which was a small little cage, basically, where they kept the the sick, weak little lambs, because sometimes, you know, sheep will have, for example, will have twins, and she won't have milk for both, and then one would end up in the sick pen, for example. And he entered the sick pen, and the next moment I saw him drag out a lamb by its hind legs. And I thought to myself, what on earth is going on there? What is he doing? But I thought maybe the sheep, the lamb had passed in the evening, and he's just sort of taking it out of the sheep pen. But the next moment I saw that the lamb was kicking, right? Almost like, leave me, man. What are you doing? Why are you dragging me? And I sort of sat forward and thinking, what on earth is going on here? And the next moment, this guy picked up a rock and he started beating down on this tiny, frail, innocent little being. And I'm jumping up, and the dogs are barking, as you can only imagine. And my coffee, you know, is falling to the floor, and I'm running across the porch. And, you know, as life would have it, I'm struggling with the garden gate, struggling to get it open. And I'm shouting at this guy to quit it, you know, stop, stop, what are you doing? And I'm running, you know, to him. And this guy, whether he couldn't hear me or refused to do so, I don't know to this day, but finally I reached him. He was just continuing beating down on his lamb, reaching. I pushed him to the ground and I just fell, you know, to the ground next to this tiny little lamb as it was literally breathing its last breath. And I was just held it in my arms, and I was just weeping. And I just remember, it is as if my mind couldn't process what had just happened. I just kept on saying over and over for at least 5 minutes, why? That single word, why? It's as if I wanted to stop asking why, but I couldn't. Something happened in my mind couldn't process what had happened. So there was just sitting, weeping, shouting, why? So, yeah, there were countless similar stories, and just had a profound impact on our lives, both my wife and mine.
So how did you turn that? Yeah, that is really amazing. How did you turn that from sort of despair and sadness and frustration at what was being done on the farm into your veganism? What was the sort of lots of small steps or one big step? How did that go?
So we basically, both my wife and I, basically quit eating meat almost immediately. I think it took me about 3 weeks from moving to the farm to the point, you know, where I stopped eating meat. And so too did my wife. At the time, it took her 4 months to move to the farm. But, you know, within 3 weeks of me moving there, just through the stories that she heard, she was no longer eating meat, right? Now, the question, obviously, that one can ask is, why didn't I, and then later the two of us, why didn't we move away? Because obviously it didn't align with our new vegan morals, but it's a complex, and it was a complex situation, because when I went vegan, although we never called ourselves vegan because we felt unworthy of the title, because we were still being paid off of the backs of the suffering animals, although we stopped eating meat, right, and dairy and all of it. But we didn't feel worthy of the titles. But we all of a sudden got a new vision of turning this farm into a sanctuary. And I knew if I can hang in there for 2 years, as the deal was supposed to be, then I'm going to take over from my grandfather and I can turn it into sanctuary. So instead of leaving, because I knew no good's going to come of it if I leave, I have to hang in there, because in our minds it was going to be this beautiful vegan utopia. And again, there was a lot of sentiment to this thought, because if you can imagine at that point, you know, the farmers had been in, or would have been in our bloodline, if we can put it so, for around about 250 years. Can you imagine all the blood that was spilled in those 250 years due to the meat industry? Now imagine turning that into a vegan utopia. So we decided, no, we're going to hang in there. And we had a couple of opportunities to move away. And very often I would come home in the evenings and I would tell my wife, X, Y, and Z happened today and I can't stand it anymore. I can't stand the blood and the gore anymore. I think we should just move away. And then we would sit down, look one another in the eyes and just say, no, we've got this vegan dream. And so we started building a business plan for a self-sustaining vegan utopia, like an animal sanctuary, right? So that really motivated us to keep going. So this neighbor of ours phoned me late this afternoon, and they were in the process of moving away, and he said, listen, JH, as you know, I still wanted to swing by your guys' place and just to come say thank you for everything, but unfortunately I'm running out of time, so I'm just, hence the call, we're leaving early tomorrow morning, this is it, thank you for everything, bye-bye. And we shared a couple of thoughts, and as I was about to hang up the phone, right, I was already sort of on my way of putting down the phone, I got this ping from the universe, and I said, wait, hang on. And he was like, yeah, what's happening? And I said, you know, the last time I was over there at your place, I remember seeing these three little Indian runner ducks. Now, I don't know if you guys have ever seen Indian runner ducks, but they are the cutest thing alive. If any of the listeners haven't seen them, please do yourself a favor and go Google it. They are almost funny looking, but the cutest thing alive. I said, I remember you have three Indian runner ducks. What are going to happen to them? And he said, well, funny you should ask. One of the guys who worked for me, you know, I had just given them for this guy, for these guys, there were three guys working there. I gave each of them a runner duck, and they had just come to collect them, and they're on their way now to the one guy's house to go cook them for dinner. Oh. And I said, wow. Not on my watch. And I remember I jumped in the car and rushed over to his place. And as I said, it's like 30K's gravel road, right? So you can only go so fast. And then eventually got there, went over to these guys' house, said, please, guys, can I get these little runner ducks? And the guy said, no, they were gifted to us. And I said, well, I'll buy them from you. So I ended up buying the runner ducks from them, took them home. And so my wife and I said, okay, well, this is the start of our little sanctuary. So we started this very unofficial little sanctuary with three Indian runner ducks. And we said, we're not going to go looking for more animals. The right animals will find us. And as life would have it, we blinked twice. And we had more than 50 animals living there with us. All, you know, that come from horrible circumstances. So that kept us going. You know, it was this unofficial sanctuary. And every night we would go sit there with them with a guitar and a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and just love on them and just spend time with these animals. And we just drew inspiration from that and kept an eye on the future. You know, to the day where we could turn the farm into a sanctuary. So, yeah, so you had the tough, you had the blood and the gore. And I never shied away from that. I always made sure that I knew what was going on. I saw the fear and I saw the blood. Although I never did the killing myself, I saw it for what it was. I knew how wrong it was, and I didn't just want to turn my back on it. I didn't want to be disconnected with it. I wanted to feel everything there was to be felt. That was on the one hand. And on the other hand, you had this lovely little animal sanctuary at the back of our house. So you had these opposite worlds. Yeah, it's a hectic story.
It's mad. It's just incredible that all happened. Just mad. Fair play to you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that's a really incredible.
Of course, you know, you had a quite, you know, tough time. But then what happened was right on a verge where we ended up spending about 3 years there, and right on the verge of us having to take over. COVID was already at, you know, we were at the height of COVID and the shareholders weren't making money, and there was like big scale droughts in the region. And then they started backpedaling on their commitments to my wife and I and said, no, they, you know, they're losing too much money. The deal ain't going to work. They want to sell off the farm, right? So some of the shareholders said, no, we want to sell off the farm. Some of the shareholders said, no, we made a commitment to JH and his wife, Al. We can't backpedal. So then all of a sudden, these two groups were in a fight with one another, and we weren't involved. We were basically just spectators looking in on the chaos and the fighting. And they end up taking one another to court, and they just said, you know, for the time being, while this court case runs its course, everybody needs to move away from the farm. They're going to rent it out to the neighbors. And unfortunately, you know, JH and I will also have to move away until, you know, this court case is settled. It was a big story, and it's still going on. It's almost 3 years later. They're still fighting in court. And so there we were at the end of 2020 in absolute dire straits. This is my wife and I, heartbroken, because a couple of things. Our dream is now gone, right? So we could no longer, we in our minds, we're on the verge of losing the farm. Okay, we could potentially move back there one day, but there's no guarantee. So we had just witnessed, you know, as I said, the blood and the gore for almost 3 years. Now the vision of the sanctuary is gone. And on top of all of this, we have to give up our own little sanctuary, which at the time had more than 60 animals in it, right? So we were completely heartbroken. And what's more is we were in financial dire straits because we had spent all of our money taking care of the animals in a little sanctuary. We had no support, right? We never asked for a dime. And we now had to rehome them to other sanctuaries and to, you know, to good houses. And we had to pay good people. We end up paying like for feed a year in advance. So we ended up leaving the farm at the end of 2020, heartbroken, severely depressed myself, severely depressed because of the blood and the gore witness. The dream was gone. So that's in the state in which we left, with, you know, COVID being, you know, as it was, especially in the third world country. I mean, there were no economic, you know, prospects on the horizon. We were ruined financially. So, I don't want to take up the entire conversation, but I just want to say that, and I'll tell you more about it if you want to know. But that is how I ended up being almost lured and tricked into the dairy industry of all things, not knowing that it was being, you know, that was waiting for me in the US.
We definitely want to hear about how you got tricked into it.
Good stuff. I'm glad. I'm so glad to hear this, because I want to talk about it, man. It was a terrible situation. So as I said, we were in dire straits. I was on Facebook the one day, and I connected with a very old friend of mine. And he was living in, I think he still is, we had lost contact. But anyway, he was living in the States, in America. And him and I started talking. And he knew nothing of my life, and I knew nothing of his life. And it's just the next moment, you know, not even knowing my personal circumstances, he said, JH, would you ever consider moving to America? Because he said that he's in the process, he helps to recruit South African guys to go work there for a local farmer in North Dakota. And I was, you know, being in dire straits, I was like, man, if this can help us survive financially, sure. Connect me with the farmer, which he then did. The next day, I got a call from the farmer. Him and I spoke for like an hour. He took a liking in me. You know, I don't really understand his reason behind it, but I had done a master's degree in organizational leadership, and he said, yeah, this is what I need. I need a good manager to come in. And he said he has like a lot of problems of the guys working for him, all South Africans, and their relationships are all broken between him and them. And he needs me to come and intervene and, you know, be a middleman between him and them. And he pitched this big vision to me, and I was all excited about it. And I said, Just tell me one thing, man. Are there any animals on the farm? Because by then you can only imagine how fed up I was for the animal in, you know, farming industry. I wanted nothing to do with it. And he said, and I'll never know his reasoning for it, but he said, I'll never forget it. He said, not unless you count the dog. And him and I sort of shared a laugh because he was telling me that, you know, they are grain producers, right? That this is what they do. And this is the area of the farm that I'm going to be working in, you know. And so I went there. My wife stayed behind in South Africa, went all by my lonesome. And with the literally with the last money we had, I bought a plane ticket. And 2 weeks later, I rocked up there in North Dakota in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere. And as we were driving into this guy's farm, there was a massive feedlot with, you know, approximately 2,500 dairy cows in it. And I thought, well, it must, surely it belongs to a neighbor. Just to find out, no, this feedlot belongs to this farmer. I'm not going to be working in this industry. It was, my mind was blown. It all happened so fast. I struggled to make sense of it all. But fortunately, I was working, you know, in a different sector of the farm, but it really bothered me. And whilst working there for the first couple of days, I sort of kept an eye on the feedlot and I saw that there were countless deceased cows lying spread out through the feedlot, dead, trampled to semi-mints in their own dung. Some of them, you know, had severed limbs and, you know, their skulls were crushed. It was brutal. It was absolutely brutal. So on my first Sunday, my first afternoon off was a Sunday afternoon, was my first Sunday then. I asked the farmer, listen, do you mind? You don't have to pay me. Can I take the skid steer and can I at least take these cows from the feedlot? Because I asked the guy who operated the feedlot, right? He was a Ukrainian guy. I asked him at one point in that week leading up to that Sunday, when are you going to take these cows, these deceased cows from the pens? This is brutal, man. And he took offense by my question and he basically said, never. Right. And he said they can trample them into the dirt for all I care. I'll never forget those were his words, using well with a couple of swear words or so forth. He was really offended by my question. So I ended up asking the farmer, this is how, you don't have to pay me. Can I at least just give them a proper burial? So he said, that's fine. So I took the skid steer, took them out, and then I got the call and said, no, you can't bury them. You have to stack them beside the feedlot. Right, you have to stack them there. And whilst taking them out, man, I was just weeping. It just broke my heart seeing these cows in this state. You know, as I said, severed limbs. And, you know, can you imagine being trampled to death and into the mud, you know, to semi-mince by your own friends and family? Can you believe? I mean, it's yeah, crazy. So I stacked them there and I was like crying. And finally, I was done. And I write in my book, I said it was 22 deceased cows, right? But it was way more than that. I just ended up taking photos of 22. Some of them I couldn't get to. And why I took the photos is because as I was leaving for the house weeping, I got a phone call from a farmer said, listen, you have to go back. You have to go take photos of the deceased cows' ears because they have tags in their ears. So that I know as a farmer, I can know which cows you took out of the pen. And I said, or out of the pens, I said, how am I supposed to do that? You're looking at a mountain of deceased cows. I mean, you look at approximately 36 cows or something like that, right? How am I going to get to the cows in the middle? I was basically just said, listen, you just make a plan, man. So picture me climbing a mountain of deceased rotten carcasses, scratching and clawing my way to look for these ear tags, and the smell and the sight, man, it just broke me. I was already depressed, but it just broke me. And unfortunately, things went from bad to worse because the farmer really liked that act. You know, the fact that I was willing, you know, that I suggested it and I was willing to do it for free. And he was like, he made it like into a religious thing, right? He said, now I've been praying for someone like you, you know, somebody who gives a damn, you know, and I feel like, you know, you were sent here for a reason. And so he told me, he said, listen, the guy who ran the feedlot, he's been doing it for 15 years. But apparently he said, I heard via the grapevine that this guy's going to leave my service in a couple of months' time. But I'm not going to let him catch me, JH. You know, I'm going to catch him before he catches me. So I'm going to, you know, out of the old, I'm going to kick him out and I'm going to put you in charge. You are now the new leader of the feedlot. And I was like, no way, Jose. There's no way. You don't understand. I am so against what is happening in this feedlot, because trust me, if ever there was a hell, if hell is real, it's you know, you can find it at your local feedlot. The things that I saw at a distance was just brutal beyond all comparison. So as I said, I want nothing to do with it. And he said, basically, my way or the highway. He pointed to, you know, the gravel road leading away from his farm. He said, you see that road there? You want to take that road, and it's going to lead to a tar road, and you can hitchhike your way to the nearest town. And if you take this road, you can hitchhike to the city, which is like 3 hours drive. You ain't going to do what I tell you. You're gone. Yeah. And I went home that evening, and I'm really ashamed by it, but I made the decision to stay and to take over the feedlot, knowing that it was the wrong thing to do. But in my mind, you know, I was like, if I don't do it, I'm not going to get paid at the end of the week, which means we're not going to have a roof over our heads. Even my wife back home, we're not going to have food to, you know. So, you know, one's mind tends to run away with you in moments like that. But I stayed and I started running this guy's feedlot, and I did so for about 100 days, which involved the artificial inseminating of approximately 50 dairy cows per day, which absolutely broke me. And I'm not the victim. I just want to make that as clear as daylight. I'm not the victim. The real victims were the cows, and the cows were still, you know, living in these atrocious circumstances. But there I was, a lover of animals, with my biggest vision of wanting to serve the vegan animal liberation movement, now artificially inseminating dairy cows, up to 50 cows per day sometimes. It's so the depression just kicked in like you won't believe, working sometimes 16 hours a day in tough conditions and being a part of that. It was poisonous. I tried to make the most of it. I would go in early in the mornings, like a half an hour before the day would start, and I would just go love on the cows, and I would just stand there in the middle of the pens, and they would just come, and they're so kind and gentle and curious, and they'll always be sniffing and always nibbling at your suit, because you're wearing these thick suits, because now you're working in the North Dakota in winter, you know, minus 38 degrees Celsius, and me and the cows would sometimes kick a football around. And if you've ever seen Happiness, it's a bunch of cows running around playing with a football. So I was sort of torn into, you know, just loving the cows and doing my best to treat them as nicely as humanly possible under tough circumstances. But then again, man, yeah. As you can imagine, you know, the artificial insemination process is nothing to laugh about. It's exploitation to the worst degree. So the depression, just for me, it just kicked in, and to the point where I had no will to live anymore.
That must have been really, really challenging.
So how did you get out of it all then?
Mm.
So one night me and the guys working on the farm, we lived in this dilapidated house at the side of like this old forest. And the one night when I was so depressed, I just wandered into the woods. And it was snowing, you know, thick snow. And I was wandering into the woods. And I remember going and I sat down by the small little creek. And I had this old little rustic blade in my pocket. And I was beginning to fiddle away, you know, at my wrist. I was just sort of making these tiny cuts. And I'm just in that moment just saying that, this is it for me, man. I'm just going to end it right here, man. I cannot stand to wake up tomorrow morning and continue this brutality. The animal, the meat and dairy industries has now killed me for good. I'm going to cut off my wrist. This is my end right here. And it was pitch black, right? It was dark outside. And in that moment, sitting by that creek, an enormous elk with these gigantic antlers came walking straight towards me from the opposite side of the creek. He came walking down the slope right at me. And I was sitting there thinking, this can't be. Surely this elk must be able to see me. I'm seeing him, for goodness sake. I mean, I'm like 10 meters away from him. Surely he must see me. And if he can't see me, surely he must be able to smell me, right? But still, it kept on walking straight at me. So I started backpedaling somewhat, and I'm just sitting there observing this glorious animal and just trying to get my head around it. Why is it still approaching the creek and in the process of approaching me? And then I saw, you know, at second glance, I saw that it had been shot. I'm saying it because I don't know if it was a he or a she. I still don't know to this day, but it had been shot in the face of all places, right? In the bottom jaw, and that its entire bottom jaw was dangling in the wind. So his entire bottom jaw was removed from his face, was dangling like a wet cloth in the wind. There was blood everywhere. And again, my heart just broke and just said, I could not believe. I'm thinking, like, what are we as a species doing to these poor animals, right? So this animal, this elk, was so desperate for water in his or her last minutes alive, because it was surely going to die. There was no way that it would have survived that gunshot, right? It was so desperate that it just needed to get to that water, Kamehalai water, you know, despite me sitting right there. And it stuck its face to the water and it tried drinking water, and it wandered off into the night. Surely, you know, on his way to go lie down somewhere and just, you know, die off. And I began to follow its trail, and it was quite easy to do because I had the small cell phone light and it was bleeding profusely. So you've got red blood in and on white snow. So it was quite easy to follow his tracks, right? So I ended up following it for several hours that night. Finally, I lost its trail, but whilst walking, whilst following its trail, I just dedicated my life to the cause, to the animal liberation cause. I just found the will to live and the will to continue fight within me. I just knew in that moment, no, this does not need to be the end for me. I can still turn it around. I can turn my life around, and I can fight for what's good. This doesn't have to be the end of my story, you know. It's the end of a couple of horrific chapters, but I can still hopefully inspire others through what I went through and what I saw firsthand. And I never went back to work. I resigned the following day, never went back to work. The farmer actually took it quite well. He said, well, you know, you're always welcome back. It was a joy having you, but it is what it is. And he organized a lift for me to the city, which is like 3 hours away. And I came home not knowing what's going to wait for me on this side, because COVID was still very much, you know, it was still, you know, at the height of COVID, not knowing what our lives are going to look like, how we're going to sustain ourselves. But all of a sudden, none of it mattered. I say I, but I mean, my wife is a way better person than I am. And she's my biggest cheerleader. She never wanted me to go to stage in the first place. The first evening I phoned her and told her of the feedlot, long before I started working in the feedlot, she said, just come home. Just come home. Just follow your heart. You're not following your heart. So things ain't going to work for you, Jade. You got to come home. Of course, I didn't listen. But finally, I came home. And so there we were, my wife and I, you know, in 2021, having to rebuild our lives. And finally, we could call ourselves vegans, although we had stopped eating meat and dairy long, many years before this. But we were now free, man. We were no longer getting paid off of the backs of innocent animals. So we could now live bold and happy vegan lives and just rebuild our lives, yeah.
Wow.
What a story, man.
That's incredible. You've seen some bad stuff there. That's incredible to come out the other side like that elk kind of dragged you through, didn't it? Even in its last minutes.
Sure.
That's incredible.
His death almost saved my life.
Yeah.
It's incredible. I couldn't have written a better story, you know. It's truth can really be stranger and I guess more profound than fiction sometimes.
Definitely. So you're back in South Africa now. You've written a book about your experiences and also some children's books as well.
Sure. So I went home and I started writing my book. It's called Ex-Farmer Goes Vegan, right? I wanted to make the title as self-explanatory as possible. Yeah. I think I managed to do that. So, but it was a tough ride, let me tell you. I mean, I still sometimes have nightmares reliving some of the stuff that I saw. So I would write for a day or two and then I would have to take a break. And the children's books came into play when in those moments where I needed to take a break, where I needed to approach veganism from a fun and colorful light. So that's how I got involved with children's literature. Not because I set out to do so, but because I needed a break from, you know, the severity of writing my own book. So my wife, then when I finished the first children's book, my wife was inspired. She said, you know, Jage, I really love this book. And I was a part of this journey. I want to do the illustration. So she began teaching herself to do the illustrations. And today she's a full-time illustrator. Life can be crazy, man. Yeah, so she's illustrated all the children's books. She was very involved with my own book, Ex-Farmer Goes Vegan. And at the same time, I just wanted to give back, right? So started volunteering at a lot of vegan organizations. And at the same time, I started a small little life coaching practice because I had just survived suicide and severe depression. So I wanted to give back and that took off quite nicely. So I spent like a year and a half to 2 years doing a lot of coaching, helping people. I mean, as I said, it was the height of COVID. Many people were searching for answers and people were scared. And so it was just a timing thing, you know, it came at a good time. And then at the end of last year, at the end of 2022, my wife and I just made a call and say, we want to go in full time in this vegan thing. We've been through so much and we've seen so much. We just want to take it to the next level. We just want to lay it all down and see what's going to come of it. And in the process, I finished my book. We started a website. We ended up taking on way too much. I closed the coaching practice. I started coaching only in the vegan space, which was tremendous. Just a quick story. We're in the process of collaborating with another vegan group. I can't say too much about it, but I just want to put this out there. It's a beautiful little story. I was contacted by a mom in the UK. And she said, I saw that you do coaching, life coaching in the vegan space. My son is 10 years old And he's being severely bullied at school because he's a vegan. And he's saying that he wants to commit suicide. He can't do it anymore. He can't stand it anymore. And that led my wife and I to write a book series as inspiration for vegan kids. It's so just to inspire vegan kids to continue the good fight. So it's more than mere children's literature. Life is funny. It's as Steve Jobs said, you can never connect the dots of your life looking forward. It's only when you look back, you see that the one thing led to the other. And we made many mistakes along the way, you know. We took on way too much, and then we have to refocus and redesign. And so we're still in that process, doing a lot of writing. I just wanted to put it out there. Our website is called veganismhaswon.com. Veganism has won, like it has triumphed, and it all began with it winning in my life because I wanted to die, and it won in my life. It gave me a purpose for living. So that's where the website's name started, and my book is available on our website free of charge. So if you're in sound of my voice and you want something good in a vegan space to read for free, you can go to our website. We've also, one of our children's books are on there called Freya and the King. It's also available free of charge. So please feel free to go get those, to go get your ebook copy of those books.
Some of the feedback that we've had from vegan parents is that there isn't a huge amount for vegan kids, and a lot that we've spoken to have had, their kids have been homeschooled because of issues at school and stuff. So that will be a great resource for some of our listeners to use for some of their kids. So that's really great,
fantastic.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That's really moving.
There's nothing better than a hunk of prime Labrador steak, wonderfully marbled. And that is almost entirely dependent on how it's produced. Elwood's Organic Dog Meat has complete control of this entire journey. So I'm here at Elwood's Farm to find out a little more about it.
Welcome to Elwood Farms.
Thank you very much, Elwood.
I hear you do a bit of barbecuing.
I do a little bit of barbecuing every now and then, yes.
From a chef's point of view, consistency is key for everything.
It doesn't matter if it's a Rottweiler ribeye, a Pyrenees mince, or a lab sirloin.
You can always tell when the dog comes from a place where it was well reared. And every step has to be right, doesn't it? Oh, you should see these guys. So, from an Elwood's point of view, there's complete traceability.
Absolutely. Unrivaled traceability, so it's fine.
Every single piece of dog meat?
Yeah, from pub to farmer's market.
Everything the dog's been fed?
Everything about it.
For each dog?
Yeah. Only Marks and Spencer's and Whole Foods do this.
Where else can people order from?
From elwooddogmeat.com. That's ELWOOD. Dogmeat.com.
For top quality meat from dogs for people. Meat that's local, sustainable, and humanely harvested. There's only Elwood's Organic Dog Meat.
They seem pretty friendly, don't they? They're more responsive to me than my kids, to be honest.
One of the things that I'm really keen to explore is what the reaction was amongst your friends and family once you had the, once you came to veganism and, you know, you left farming and animal agriculture, because obviously it's been in your family for 250 years. And all of a sudden you've turned your back on it. What was their reaction?
I was, both my wife and I, we were quite fortunate that we never got a lot of backlash from them. I don't really know what they think. I can only suspect. I know that they're not in favor of it. And I know initially when we were still on the farm that most of them were just sort of hoping that it was only a phase. It's going to, you know, blow over and we're going to, you know, get back into it and take the farm to new heights. But we never had any confrontation regarding the vegan thing. Of course, they hoped that it would blow over. It didn't. So we are still in good communication with them. We still love one another. However, they don't really support us, not in a vegan course. For example, we had now written these, you know, several children's books and my own book. And, you know, you put a lot of effort in them. Love and life into those pages, and then you send it out and you say, hey friends, hey family, we've written this book and guess what, it's available for free. And you know how many of them have gone to our site to download it? Not a single one. Not a parent, nor a sibling, nothing. So that sort of paints the picture that they don't really support us in what we're doing, but that's okay. Such is life, and we've learned to live with it. And I guess, but we're still trying to build bridges, you know, and we still love one another. It's just when it comes to veganism, we just don't see eye to eye, I guess.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Have you met many other vegans? What's the sort of vegan situation in South Africa? I know you said you live in a fairly remote place, but do you have any in your, you know, if you come across anyone in your local community?
It's definitely on the up. We always say, it always feels to us as, you know, as South Africans, as we sort of 10 years behind the UK and the USA, right? So the vegan movement is slowly but surely making inroads. As I said, at the age of 29, I'd never even met a single vegan. Today, I'm turning 35 in December, and now we are part of like a big vegan group here in the Garden Route where we live, of approximately 30 odd people, you know, who get together from time to time, and we have vegan picnics, and we have several other vegan friends who live, you know, spread out through South Africa. And most restaurants in South Africa now have vegan options. We don't have many full-on vegan restaurants, for example, but, you know, we've got several sanctuaries. And, you know, so the movement is going. We're getting there. Yes, we're 10 years behind the UK. So I think what you should do is you should remind yourself of maybe what the UK vegan movement was like 10 years ago. And then that will sort of paint a picture where we're at. Yeah, so we are getting there. Slowly but surely.
Yeah. Well, 10 years ago, neither of us were vegan, and certainly wasn't a thing in supermarkets, you know, with the amount of choice that you have in the various sections of the supermarket that you get now. 10 years ago,
for sure.
Nowhere near.
Of course. Yeah, no, we're getting there, because I think then we may be ahead where you guys were 10 years ago, because we now have several options in your supermarket. So it's not tough, man. It's easy to be a vegan in South Africa today. Yeah, you just gotta choose compassion, man.
That's it. That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
So where'd you get your protein from these days?
So my wife and I we stick to a very simple diet. We love homemade seitan. I don't know if you guys, you know, are into that, but and we still do the traditional way of making it. It's a lot of work, let me tell you. We would spend like an hour and a half on a Sunday afternoon, and we put on some music, and she'll make a batch and I'll make a batch, and because it's, you know, you take flour and then you add water and you sort of massage the starch out of it, and then the protein stays behind, and that's a lot of protein, man, let me tell you. And it tastes amazing. We don't miss meat whatsoever, so we do a lot of seitan. It's high in protein, and we've done the test, both my wife and I. We don't have protein deficiency or anything like that, so we're going quite strong. Then and now, you know, we'll try some of these meat replacements, you know, that you buy in the supermarkets, and not too keen on them. That's just for taste reasons. And then, you know, your basic nuts and so forth. But generally speaking, when it comes to protein, man, it's seitan all the way.
Brilliant.
I love that. So you mentioned that there's some good choices and you've got a bit of a community. Have you got any sort of venues or anything that you want to give a particular sort of shout out to that are particularly accommodating for you?
Well, unfortunately not, because as I said, we don't have
nothing specific,
full on vegan restaurants. Yeah. So we're fortunate that most restaurants, for example, the coffee shops have vegan options, and we're very grateful for it. But we're still very much in, you know, the trial and error phase. And as vegans, we will go and try something and then go to another place and try that. But we're still very much in the, and we would almost prefer the vegan picnics, you know. Sort of go sit by the river or at the beach and get together, you know, around a campfire. As South Africans, we love the outdoors, so we're more into that. So when it comes to restaurants specifically, no specific shout out that I want to give. I would like to say that you guys did give me a heads up about a favorite product that I would like to give these guys a shout out, because this is a South African brand and I'm so proud of them. It's I don't know them personally. Let me say I'm not being
You haven't got shares in it. No, that's fine.
No shares. Not yet. I don't. But it's called buttermilk with an A, not butter, but buttermilk. And it's they make the most divine oat milk, and it's by far my favorite product, because I'm a coffee snob. So we just absolutely, we only recently came across it, and my wife and I, we are hooked. Buttermilk, it's a delicious oat milk, yeah.
Nice, okay. I don't think that's one that's come, that's not come here yet, I don't think.
No, if I get my shares, I'll bring it over to you. How about that?
Okay. Yeah.
That's a deal.
So what advice would you give to someone if they came to you wanting to make the change? What would you say to them?
Gosh, man. Please, for the love of all things pure, if it's on your heart to do it, do it. Choose compassion, man. It's easy. It's easy to choose compassion. If you got a choice to choose either compassion or on the one side, or blood and gore on the other, why on earth would you not choose compassion? So please, if it's on your heart to try it, give it a go. If you struggle, reach out to us, man. I'll do a video call with you. I'll do my best to inspire you. Mm-hmm. But please give it a go. And from my perspective, please do it for the right reasons. Do it for the animals. Don't do it for selfish reasons. If you do it for the animals, it's easy, and it's very hard to fall away, if I can put it so. But we often hear of vegans who gave it up. And you know, I don't want to be overtly critical, but I always ask myself, you know, what were their initial reasons for going vegan? Was it for the animals? Because I always think if you go vegan for the right reasons, for the animals, man, there's no turning back.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's it. You've got to keep the animals front and center. That's the thing that keeps us in the right lane. Absolutely. I love that. Okie dokie. One of the questions that we often ask is, what's the best thing about being vegan? But I think for me now, it's having spoken to you. but for you, what's the best thing about being vegan?
I never really sit down and take stock, to be quite honest with you. But just thinking about it in the moment, it's, man, I'm still alive. This, to me, I don't want to sound overly dramatic, but to me, this is borrowed time. And I wake up every morning and I remind myself of that fact, because to me, it's a fact. from my perspective, I'm not supposed to be here anymore. And it really gave me a reason to be here, to continue living. So I'm just so grateful, man. I really do my best to live a life of gratitude, and it comes quite easy having sort of seen what I've seen. I'm humbled by it. So I guess the fact that I'm still here, that's is the best thing for me about being vegan.
100%, man.
That's a great answer.
Oh dear.
Okay.
So I'm just getting through for the minute. So who's your vegan inspiration? And you're being pretty damn inspirational. Right,
yeah, yeah.
So, shame, man. Oh, guys, that's too kind.
That's why I was pausing, because I was trying to think how to word it.
You're too kind.
Who's your vegan inspiration?
Well, let me put it this way. Somebody who I really admire in the vegan space, and I can't stress this enough, is Moby, the singer, right? And I had the honor of being on his podcast about a month ago. And
really?
I was completely starstruck. Yeah. Because I love the music and I love the human. And just I'm just in awe of that guy, especially because I mean I have nothing to lose because I'm not famous, but that guy was he's this big name, and he's just choosing to live this bold vegan life with the animal liberation tattoos, and he just doesn't care who says what, and he's just doing massive, positive work in the vegan movement. So, I'm really just inspired by him. I guess most of all.
Yeah, he is a legend. And you were on his podcast. I listened to that podcast. When is it out? Has it gone out now?
It's not out. They said that they'll let me know. Apparently, it will be released at some, I think, in either November or December. They said at the end of the year. So they only release one episode per month. So they said at the end of the year. So,
Can jump the queue.
Yes.
We can jump ahead of Moby, and then we can just pretend that. Well, I'll edit this bit out, and I'll just say that Moby heard you on our pod and thought, I've got to get this guy on.
Of course. Let's do that, then. Yeah, I'll play along.
Fantastic.
Man.
Oh, wow. I mean, getting to meet, I know virtually, but still, but getting to talk to someone, with that sort of kudos within the movement is incredible, though. That must have been a hell of a moment.
More importantly, did you get to meet Bagel?
No, I didn't. I didn't. No. I got to meet him and his partner, Lindsay. So that was it. But let me tell you, talk about a humbling experience. But let me just say, you guys are awesome too. All right. Let's just put it out there, man. You guys are inspiring me so much. I just went to, when we took a quick break, I went up to just go have a quick word with my wife. And I just said, man, these guys. And I said, I told them, whenever we go to the UK, if they come down to South Africa, we must meet up. It's so inspiring meeting you guys. And seeing, take time out of your busy schedules to keep this brilliant podcast going. It's marvelous, the work that you guys are doing.
We will definitely add South Africa to our forthcoming world tour.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And you do that, and you've got a place to stay here by us. All right.
Happy day. Thank you very much.
So, again, this feels like a bit of a moot question because I feel like you've given all of us some hope. But one of the things that we've experienced ourselves and a lot of our guests have experienced is Vegetopia, which is the anguish of vegans, that vegans feel living in a non-vegan world, which you've described very vividly this evening about the anguish that you felt as being a vegan in a explicitly non-vegan, not just a world, but your immediate environment. But do you have any hope for the future of veganism?
Of course, it gets tough sometimes, doesn't it? I mean, you guys know. I mean, it's so easy to fall into sort of a nihilistic view of the world. But I just fight for that hope, man. I just don't give myself an out. I don't have another choice. I get up early in the morning, and I know, because I come from a background of severe depression, as I explained to you guys. So I know that if I don't get up early in the morning and spend some time working on my mental health, I ain't gonna survive it. So I wake up early every morning, and there's nothing good in me. It's just a surviving mechanism, right? And I meditate on that hope, on finding and searching for that hope and finding the light in this dark reality that is a non-vegan world. So I just don't give myself an out. So yes, am I hopeful? Immensely so. I'm inspired, you know, talking to, you know, guys such as yourself. Here we are, like-minded individuals from two different hemispheres, literally on, you know, the opposite side of the world. So I'm hopeful, man. I'm hopeful tonight. We're going to get it. I think I just always remind myself that when it comes to veganism, I'm on the right side of history. And that's an honor, man. And that's a reason to continue the good fight. So am I hopeful? That was a long way of saying yes, indeed so.
I love that.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah, I've been feeling quite environmentally depressed recently. But someone mentioned to me that Just Stop Oil are like, they're a sort of a protest group here in the UK, especially, and across Europe as well.
I know of them, yeah.
Yeah, Just Stop Oil, for example, are kind of like today's suffragettes because they're currently doing things that are often illegal and often extremely unpopular, but they're on the right side.
Sure. Yeah. Wow.
And we're in that boat as well, because we're the ones that are doing something completely different outside of what's expected of us. Wow. And yet, but we're in the end, people will realize, oh, actually, do you know what? They were right all along.
Wow. And may it come soon, man. I believe it will happen. A major shift will happen in our lifetime still. But what a privilege, man. I always just say, tell myself that, listen, Jay, you get to live this vegan life. Don't see it as a hassle. You get to be on the right side of history. You get to speak for the voiceless victims. Don't even allow your mind to go to a place, you know, where it's nihilistic or where it's tough or it's where you get depressed about it. I just always remind myself, man, you get to live it. It's an honor, man. It's anyway.
That's it. Absolutely. And that seems like a fantastic place to finish, because you've been such an inspiration. That's been absolutely fascinating talking to you, JH. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure getting to speak with you.
Guys, thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate it. You are such kind, gentle souls, and it was a massive honor sitting down with you.
Wow.
Holy moly. That was incredible.
I didn't know what to expect going into that. And I wasn't expecting that at all.
Man alive, he's just blown my mind there. What a guy. What a guy.
I think I might have said this before, but it's always good to quit at the top of your game. Is this the last episode?
No, you want to see who we've got lined up for our next episode?
I know. I saw on the calendar who we've got next. Oh my God. It'll be a whole different story, that one. Jesus.
But this is, that was absolutely fantastic. And definitely check out his website, check out his book. And and if you've listened to this, then check him out on these Moby podcasts, because Moby heard him on our chat and copied it and thought, what a great idea to get him on.
Oh, God, can you imagine? Oh. So I'm going to say this. You don't know I'm going to say this, so you can edit whatever you want out of this bit. But
can't wait.
If anyone was affected by anything that was mentioned in that,
yes,
can you please make sure you take care of yourself? I'm going to tell Matthew now to put. We're going to put another a little warning at the beginning. If you were affected by anything that was mentioned in that, can you please just make sure you're okay? And if you need to talk to somebody, go and do so. Thank you very much. Apart from that, if anybody wants to get in touch or wants to come on the podcast or ask us any questions, then, get in touch with us. Send us a message. We're on all the social medias that I think we're on, or whichever ones you do follow us on. Just send us a message.
Do it. Or send us an email to howiveganpodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you for listening, chaps and chapesses. You have a good day. See you later. I'm a mess.
Oh, that's hilarious.